majority seems to tell me to reject intellectual inquiry, to put your critical faculty in cold storage, then there's a problem. How would you speak to the Jew who wants to negotiate between
right.
modernity and tradition?
You're right, and it's wrong what happened. These bans are wrong. I pointed out the critical thing is the role of Rav Aaron Cutler in the development of American Orthodoxy. He came to America in 1941. He died in 1962. In 21 years, he's responsible for one ban, and that is on mixed rabbinical groups, together Reform and Conservative. No other bans, period. I sat at the man's feet for the last 11 years of his life.
They didn't
ban a college in Lakewood.
He said he can't be a student in Lakewood if he didn't go to college.
That's not a ban. That's not a communal ban. He has admission policies that he wants people only to learn Torah. That's not a ban. I'm sorry. It's not a ban. A person has a right to go to admitted. My daughter is admitted, teaches at NYU. She's finishing her doctorate over there, and they have more rules than Lakewood has in terms of what she has. What a school has as a rule is not a ban. It's not a ban. It's as simple as that. He used to talk to me about my own doctoral work, so I know about what I'm speaking about. What we have now is a promiscuous use of bans instead of leading us by teaching, and it does denigrate authority. But again, I want to get back to a key point on this, that people, particularly in not Sam's part of the community, my part of the community, have to speak out. I'll give you an incident that happened in Canada, not here, but in Montreal. There was a critical case of Kedusha Ketana. A man, in a divorce case, married off his daughter before she was 12. The Torah says that she's Mekudeshes. As simple as that. And Rabbi Yashav, who then and even now is certainly the paramount authority in the yeshiva world and maybe in all of Orthodox life, said that the girl is married. You can't do anything about it. So I picked myself up, arranged to see Rabbi Yashav. He gave me one full hour. And I went at him with respect, about the negatives of what this is going to occur. That it will lead to other parents, fathers doing the same thing, because if they're involved with a get problem with their wives, it will lead to what's happened with this girl and so on and so forth. And he answered all of them. But finally he turned to me, and there was a group in the room, and he said, "Ani lo omer lo issa v'lo heta." He withdrew his issa. The girl is married right now. She got married a year and a half ago. So what I'm trying to say to all people, particularly my part of the community, not in your part of the community, it's a matter of courage. It's a matter of intelligence. It's a matter of doing what's right. It's a matter of not being intimidated. Too many of us are intimidated. I can see that. That is a problem. But you don't have to be intimidated. You have to do the right thing. And these bans are harmful. They are harmful. And what happens too often is that, particularly with books written in English, because that's been one of the primary areas of bans, someone goes to a Torah leader who hasn't read a word of English in his life, and he says, "I am knowledgeable in English, and I read this book, and it's terrible heresy, or it's whatever else, it's a Chil Hashem, and we should outlaw the book," and the rabbi wrongfully signs a ban, and then it gets distributed. And people have to protest against that.
But do the conditions for that kind of courage actually exist within your community? Aren't there not, in fact, deep repercussions for stepping out and speaking your mind and doing what you want to do? I can only speak personally because I can tell you speakers that I have invited from your side of the community who wanted to come, who were phoned and told not to speak for no reason other than there is no reason. In other words, it's just fear of dialogue. And when I spoke to them on the phone, it was, or by email, it was along the lines of, "I really can't buck this. I have interests in the community. I have people, children to marry off," and so on and so forth. So although I totally agree with you in theory that, of course, there needs to be the courage to stand up and say these things, from a practical level, I don't see, courage needs an environment to grow. And well, I don't see that.
I admit, at times I feel like a company of one. No question about it.
You are.
Okay, thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
He means that as a compliment.
I think you meant that as a compliment. I know you meant that. But at least it shows. If you look at the publications of Lakewood, Mrs. Rabbi Aaron Cutler's writings, you'll see on the title page my name as sponsoring it. They didn't take it off because I wrote in the yeshiva world, criticizing Lakewood for its submission, the schools for its submission, their mission policies, for throwing out families that use the internet, for throwing out families that go to baseball games. I wrote against it in Lakewood. The world didn't fall in. So I can't apologize for cowards. It's true. I'm a company of one. And the cowards, they fill up stadiums. But I can't help that. That's the damn truth, and it bothers me.
I think in response to the original question, the way I handle bans and things like that and the way my Haredi neighbors handle it is very different in the sense that I agree that we all need rabbinic authorities. I look for an authority who is more open-minded and has the same kind of worldview that I do. The way my neighbors handle, let's say, the Slifkin ban is they brush off with a cynical eye of politics. So they still respect their authority. They still revere their authorities. But they cynically think that it doesn't ring true with them. They just kind of set aside as they didn't really mean it. So I ask them, well, how do you know what's politics and how and what's real Judaism? They say, no, we know. Everybody knows. So that's how they navigate the problem. Now, if that's the case, they're never going to protest. Because it's politics. They don't want to get involved in politics. So they're never going to protest. They're never going to go up to the Rosh Yeshiva and say, how dare you? How could you? You ruined the... they're never going to do that. Because it's politics. We set aside politics. And that is a kind of a quietist... role, and I don't know if that's ever going to change, but the way I handle it from my modern Orthodox perspective, my YU background, is that I look for the authorities who match more my worldview, and I don't accept politics as an answer.
But I'm just surprised. I'm surprised that nobody mentioned the word Das Torah here. And I'm a little bit surprised because, I mean, even by the question, I don't know that everyone agrees that on issues that are beyond Psikat Halacha, that necessarily the opinion of a Gadol is obligatory. I mean, I don't know that we were all brought up with the idea, of respect, of learning, of education, of that people who are learned, who are thoughtful, are people that we want to be exposed to, we want to talk to them, we want to hear what they have to say, but that not necessarily we are going to make up our mind categorically based on the exact opinion that person articulates. And I almost felt as I was listening here that has become so obvious here, that Das Torah is something that is so pervasive that authority, I mean, and I'm not trying to, you know, say authority, you know, we don't have a concept of authority, but I think that there is a more nuanced understanding of authority, which is authentic, which is Torah true, which it reflects true religiosity, which reflects passion and is completely respectful of Gedolim and of Talmidei Chachamim, but it does not demand of a person to decide their hashkafa down the line according to one person or two people. They are human beings, and they are heads of institutions, and they have numerous considerations that they are taking into account when they make their decisions. We have to respect that, but not necessarily feel that we must do exactly according to the prescriptions that they give.
I would just add my question to you, Rabbi Student, is you look for the rabbi who's going to give you that answer, but they become harder and harder to find. There is a diminishing... I once said that a website that I would envision would be Shelot and Tshuvot. You put in the question you have, then you plug in the answer you want, and it tells you which rabbi to call.
That's a good one.
I think it would be very successful. And if there's anybody who wants to back me on this, I will. We could. Google will buy us out within 5 months, not even 6 months. The problem is that there's a diminishing number of rabbis for whom the non-Haredi world can turn for these kinds of answers. You know, they're sort of that we make fun of Chabad because they don't believe the Rebbe is dead. But the fact is that the modern Orthodox world doesn't believe that the Rav is dead. They are still invoking the Rav for answers and speaking about all sorts of things. I mentioned a number of people. We had a speaker, a scholar in residence at our shul this weekend, this Shabbat, and one of the things she said is, as the Rav said, sinfulness is bad. Now, I knew that sinfulness was bad, even though the Rav, I didn't know the Rav said it. But the fact is that there is now this need to invoke the name of the Rav for everything, even things that he didn't say. The Rav, and this is sort of classic in the modern Orthodox world. There's two sides of the Rav. There's two sides of Reb Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. There's two sides of the Rambam. there are all of these dead rabbis who are being used by the modern Orthodox world. Unfortunately, there are fewer and fewer living ones that really speak to the needs of the modern Orthodox world.
I would disagree. I think Dr. Hamlet is absolutely correct in that people are invoking the name of Reb Soloveitchik, but I don't agree in that it's a valid criticism. I mean, if you look historically when the Vilna Gaon died, everybody was invoking his name. It's just you have someone so brilliant, so charismatic, so all-powerful, all-overwhelming, you have to expect your students to quote him. I mean, he helped mold their lives. I never met Reb Soloveitchik. I studied under his grandson for 5 years. And I spoke to him on many issues, and he never told me what to do. Many life issues, he never said, this is that Torah, this is what you have to do. What he would do is he would talk through the issues with me. It would become clear what his opinion was, but he almost never ordered me, you have to do this. And from what I understand, Reb Soloveitchik was that way also. It's not that they disagree with the idea of authority. It's that they give you a little room to make your own decisions and make your own value judgments, taking into account the Torah values that they give over. Now, why are there so few rabbis like that who you can talk to? Well, number one, I don't believe that there are so few rabbis. And number two, there are diminished, and I believe this goes back to why there are so few modern Orthodox educators. There's one word answer, and it's reaping what we sow. It's called Zionism. The cream of the crop for the past 30, 40 years of modern Orthodoxy have been moving to Israel, more or less. And they, when they go to Israel, they're kind of drowned out by the Israeli voice in many ways. But that's where they've gone. Where have all the modern Orthodox rabbis gone? Israel. And I can't say that they're wrong for doing it. On the other hand, we're kind of abandoned. We have a less of a voice. Now, when I was in Yeshiva University, some of the top guys in the Beit Medrash, who are brilliant futures as Talmidei Chachamim and as Poskim and as Gedolim, they all went to Israel.
And got tied up in the political movements of settlement and settlement building.
Sam, I think one thing, I agree with much of what you said now, but I want to make one point about leadership, which is
we're making progress.
Leadership thing, and that is there's a difference between asking a question which in a private way about your situation or something, and asking a question which you talk in terms about what exists, let's say we call it across Klal Yisrael. It's been known for as long as things have been known in terms of the yeshiva world, that when you ask a question privately about your situation, you're far more likely to get ahead than an issa, even on things that are very critical. Whether it's birth control, whether it's going to college, what kind of job to do, whether you can do what was done in Dunwoody, and whatever else. It's just known. That is a fact of life. That they have tear and flow. It's as simple as that. When you ask a question where there's a possibility with Dama Milsa La Milsa, and people can take it out of context, whatever, they get scared. I don't think they should get scared. But there is a difference between the two.
And in fact, I mean, I have a chapter here sort of that deals with when Art Scroll and the books took some of those questions and they have made them, given them answers of one size fits all, and when the book sort of says, this is the way you have to do it. This is the shear you have to use of this, and this is the kind of thing you have to do that. That kind of flexibility that always existed, I had an answer, but it can't be publicized, that has begun to decline as well. And finally, part of the reason that you don't have that same phenomenon anymore is because the contacts between these rabbonim and the amcha who are not part of the Haredi world have diminished as well. So it's not easy for everyone to go to a Rav El Yoshiv and argue with him for an hour and get that audience for an hour, or to go to Lakewood and sponsor Lakewood but still argue with Lakewood. Most of us are in a situation where we get the answer from our local rabbi, and that local rabbi is under pressure from the right, and in the end, there's a lot less flexibility and then
there's more than you think, Sam. Let me give you an example. In your essay, you know, Contemporary Jew, which I wrote about, Mark Shapiro has a comment. Mark Shapiro writes that as an example of the chumrus mentality in the Orthodox community, you have a case of Melanta, you know, the anti-Hopper and drug or whatever else, that because it has corn syrup, whatever else, that there's chumrus and they forbid it for Passover. But he doesn't know, because he doesn't know enough about history, is that the chumrah comes from Rabbi Soloveitchik, a famous statement of Rabbi Soloveitchik in 1954, in which Rabbi Soloveitchik got up at the RCA pre-Pesach conference and gave a prohibition on Barton's candy because they used cornstarch based on a chumrah of his Zayder of Chaim Soloveitchik. But that's not the point I want to get because he does it. Take Blumenkrantz's monumental book before Pesach. You probably will count several thousand medications that are mutter. So look what happens. There's a mindset which you don't want to see, not you, but people don't want to see this from community. And that is they find ways of living. You open up, I'm sure a lot of people in this audience, Rabbi Blumenkrantz's book, to look at your medication, and you'll see small print, column after column after column, page after page after page of medication, which is mutter, and it's 99 out of 100 chances that the medication you're using is mutter for Pesach, and possibly at times based on a kulam. But it's indicative of a lot of things that happen in this community. We don't see it. And we don't see it because the frum people, in a certain sense, are responsible. Because a lot of noise is made about all of the prohibitions and all of this. But we don't see the ordinary life underneath the surface in which people are making do. And as you said this morning, in fact, to an extent, they simply are borrowing from the general society, general culture. That happens.
But for each one of those, there's somebody who says that the water in New York City is treif.
So we keep on drinking the water.
We keep on drinking, but now you have to have a filter.
I just want to get back to a point that was made before that I wanted to ask Dr. Furtzer about. It reference to sort of brain drain of rabbis, potential communal leaders in modern Orthodoxy going to Israel. And I wondered if you could comment on that.
Okay. I think that Rabbi Student made a very important point, this issue that there are a lot of people, and it started already in the 60s, after 67, a lot of very capable modern Orthodox scholars, rabbis, etc., that have moved to Israel. And I don't know if I fall into the capable category, but I certainly think that what they did was an ideal, and it was something that inspired me to move with my wife when we got married. But I think that there are some interesting conversations that have emerged from that. I mean, Professor Heilman spoke about the Shana Aleph, Shana Bet, Shana Gimel condition, which maybe is a reflection of that brain drain where there's an economic need and all these schools are created and they go and recruit here and then they all come and they're brainwashed or not brainwashed, et cetera. But I think that on that level, there's I think American Jewry, if they see Israel as a place for inspiration and a place to educate their children, I think that the issue is responsibility. I think that when educators, principals, or when parents have an Israel night, I think they should really check out the school that they send their kids to. I think that Israel can have a tremendously positive influence upon American Jewry. I think that the fact that so many capable, bright, energetic, young, modern Orthodox people are living in Israel and are educating young, modern Orthodox high school graduates in Israel is actually a source for a tremendous amount of power, energy, and renaissance. But I think that it can only develop in a positive way, which won't weaken the core, if people take a more serious interest in where they're sending their children. Or on the other side of the coin, something that I'm again studying, what's called the Torah Mitzion, Kol Torah Mitzion. I don't know if there's one in Toronto. Is there one? Okay. But sorry, I didn't know I was touching on a minefield. But in any case, there are about 30 Zionist kolels that are also been established in North America of Hesder graduates, which I think is a reflection on one hand, is a reflection of an effort to reinvigorate American Orthodoxy, but it also it's really a reflection of a kind of weakness. Whereas the Haredim are establishing kolels to do outreach, the modern Orthodox are establishing kolels to do inreach, because there is a sense, again, like Rabbi Student said, that there's this brain drain and there are no resources here to invigorate the community, so therefore we have to draft people from abroad. There's only one curve in this, which is that religious Zionism, for the most part, I don't know, maybe
the students of Rav Soloveitchik, or some of them, or Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, and some of the outgrowths of Gush, have more of a similarity, but religious Zionism and Hesder yeshivas, the ones particularly that are more influenced by the Merkaz HaRav strain, that's not the same thing as modern Orthodoxy.
Sure.
And people seem to equate the two, and they're not the same thing. Religious Zionism is also not Haredism. It's something unique to a sovereign state and to particular types of goals of living as a Jewish people in a Jewish land and the particular political and ideological factors that arise from where we live. But to think that you're going to take a Hezbernik who might know English, might not, you know, come here, they'll sit in a base medrash in your modern Orthodox school, and that's going to recreate modern Orthodoxy in America, I think that that is a little bit naive. I think that they are wonderful role models. I think that they make tremendous Yom HaTzma'ut, Yom Yerushalayim, Yom HaZikaron programs. I think that they also are doing something which is important, is making sure that Zionism doesn't disappear. That's really important. But to think that these young men and women are sort of coming and they are bringing back what we once had, it's just not the same thing. And I think that we have to be less naive, we have to be more careful, and we have to provide the guidance so that young men like maybe my son in 5 years from now can come to Toronto or Cleveland or Atlanta or Houston or all the various places where these calls exist and can interact in a positive way with young men and women who are growing up in modern Orthodox schools and really inspire them. So I think that would be a challenge and a way to use those energies of the brain drain in a positive way.
As my chat students would say, I'm with that. I wanted to ask you a last question. I want to leave time for questions from the floor. And maybe what you just said really is the start of the question, and I was going to ask it last night. It sounds like in some ways a full religious life is only possible in Israel under this model. And I'm going to tell you why I think that, because there's things that you've all been saying that have been making me increasingly frustrated, which is not an unknown emotion for me. All of you are somehow speaking to a kind of compartmentalized religious life. I've been writing down notes as you've been speaking. Go to somebody on birth control and get private suck, right? This, I feel, is a particularly contentious issue because I know for a fact that there are women, and my wife, the psychologist, could tell you this even better, who are not aware of that private suck and are, you know, 7-8 kids into their marriage and floundering because the public rhetoric of the community is not supporting the notion that they could take a break. There's a notion that came up earlier this year in this community of that had to do with Rabbi Slifkin and a note that was posted by a local rabbi here condemning his work, and one of the conversations I had after the condemnation came out was told to me that this was, quote, a private speech to his community. Right? So we have private piskei halacha, we have private speeches to our community, we have compartmentalized notions of authority, right? You mentioned that, you know, when people heard about the Slifkin ban, they sort of saw it as politics, right? So we all sort of siphon off little pieces of our religious life and put them into these types of dead zones. Now, I may be an idealist, but I've always wondered, isn't there something more? Isn't there a kind of organic, complete, unified, private, public kind of religious life in which, and I actually have to be quite frank, I'm increasingly feeling this is only possible in Israel. But nonetheless, I think we could do a lot better in the diaspora instead of siphoning off these kinds of private things. It's almost like there's a novel by Mona Simpson called Life is Elsewhere. And that's how it sounds to me. It sounds to me like, we do this here, that's elsewhere. As opposed to thinking of it as what happened to Klal Yisrael. That's my question. What happened to Klal Yisrael?
In Israel, because is part of life. We all do it. We all do it in terms of family. We all do it in terms of jobs. We all do it in terms of religious life. And it exists in Israel. The problem with Israel, the dilemma here is that, as Dr. Persica said, it's the grab of living there is so rewarding on its own with the compartmentalization. The other part of the coin is what Rabbi Studen said, which is that America has lost an enormous number of people who in a practical sense would have been far more effective in America than they are in Israel. There are modern Orthodox scholars and rabbis who simply walk the streets in Israel. When they see a guy they knew from the States, they grab him as if something to say, like a lifeboat, because they have something to spend a half an hour with or whatever else. There are too many people there who have no role. That's a fact. There are a few small number of people who have a good role. But on the other hand, they're rewarded by living in Israel.
I don't think that you can deny that the presence of Israel has fundamentally changed what it means to be a Jew in the diaspora. There's no question that particularly somebody who's serious about his or her Judaism, as I assume all Orthodox Jews are, regardless of their place on the spectrum, anyone who's serious about Judaism has to think about Israel as a serious option. It's the fulfillment of a generations-long dream of being a Jew in your own land. There's no question about that. I think that when one comes to Israel, the realities are far more disturbing. If we're talking about Orthodoxy in Israel, I think one fact needs to be remembered. For anybody who looks at Israel as the fulfillment, and I don't think that, I mean, I certainly feel very strongly about that. I spend a lot of my time in Israel. I have a couple of sons living in Israel. I have a home in Israel. I've had kids.
You're coming to speak in my graduate seminar in December.
I've had kids serve in the Israeli army. I've had kids in the Israeli yeshivas. All of that is true. But the fact of the matter is that in many ways, Orthodoxy has blown its opportunity in Israel more than anywhere else in its history. Orthodoxy had an opportunity to make Judaism attractive, engaging, involving to the entire population. It had a state apparatus that was at its disposal. It could have debated secularity, secular Zionism, all of those things with an open mind in a way that would have made people see the beauty in Orthodoxy. The fact of the matter is that second only to the Arabs, the Haredi population in Israel, which as far as most Israelis are concerned, it's all dosim, as they put it, all of them are viewed in a very negative way. And one of the great disappointments of coming to Israel, I think, for many Orthodox Jews, and I think part of that is the reason they got so caught up in the settlement process, because settlements seem like places where you can create a new Israel, outside of Israel. They're even talking about, I mean, that's the very dark side of this Orthodoxy in Israel, of creating an anti-Israel, the state of Judea, whatever it is, Yudav and Shomron, or the orange flag versus the blue flag, blue and white flag. One of the disappointments in Israel is to see how Orthodoxy has in so many ways failed and blown an historic opportunity, both to engage in Kiruv, both to engage in dialogue, to allow for a fuller fulfillment of Jewish life. The fact of the matter is that what you said may be true to some extent, but I know that in many ways, when you look at American Jewish life from Israel, there are many things about American Jewish life that are far more fulfilling than the Jewish life in Israel, which is, maybe that's the lesson of Jewish history. You need both Bavel and Yerushalayim.
Mm. You know, I said last night that I get scared about, you know, coming as the Israeli and telling American Jews, you know, what Israelis like to tell. So I'm going to be careful. Some of my friends aren't so careful, but that's okay. We agree to disagree. I said it last night. I'm in Israel not because of the mitzvah, because I didn't like American Orthodoxy or American Jewish life. It's because it's a great experiment. And I agree, like Sam said, that in a great experiment in Jewish history, it's really complicated, and like Dr. Schick said as well. I want to say something that is not academic, but I noticed there are quite a few young people here, and I was glad to see that. And at least on a personal level, I would like to share this point. Come when you are young. If you want to be a participant and not an observer, if you want to feel that you are a part of that society, you will never completely, your children will. But if you want to feel that you are accomplishing something in Israel, and you're not walking around the streets of Yerushalayim looking for a landsman so you can schmooze about, you know, the Rav or something, you know, so those are important things. But come when you are young, and or the Red Sox, yes. Well, Yankees and Red Sox, who would talk about that? But certainly not the Blue Jays, sorry. But the Raptors have Parker, who used to play for Maccabi Tel Aviv, so that's important. In any case, I think come when you are young is very important. And here's like the little knitch, and I want to be careful here. I think I learned a lot from sitting with the four of you. And throughout this conference, I'm learning a lot. But somehow, the word Slifkin really irks me. It really irks, not because I don't feel bad for him. He did something wonderful, and I've looked at the book, and I think it's really interesting. And I think there's a type of retzach ishi, that type of like personal homicide, whatever you call it, that's been done to him. It's horrible, vilification. But living in Israel, somehow, you think a conference of modern Orthodox Jews, they come together. How many times can you talk about Zutora? It's not Zutora, Zoschora, it's Zutora. Right. So, but, I mean, we spent the summer going to funerals. We had our country torn apart last summer about, you know, existential issues, about what is going to be the future of this great experiment. And it was so horrible. How do you deal with your children? They come home from school, and how do you deal with your community? And what are the values that you really care about? And how are you going to build that society? And I'm not at all trying to belittle American Orthodoxy, but somehow the proportions seem different. And I couldn't not say this because I've been feeling it all day, and I had to share it, and it's out of respect for everyone who's here.
We're actually going to start a question period now. David is going to be walking around with the mic. And if you have a question, we're going to take a bunch of questions at one time and write them down. I'm going to ask you two things. Number one, if there's somebody you're addressing your question to, please make that clear. And number two, no speeches, just the question, please.
This question is to Dr. Schick. My question is to you is, how come the Moetzes Gedolei Torah, the Das Torah, whoever they are, how come they're not saying publicly that this, when they make a ban or any other type of declaration, they're saying that this is for the klal, but it's not necessarily for the individual?
Yeah, some of the original reaction to the dialogue question was, we don't have time for it, it's too busy for it. But I think there's one arena where perhaps it's unavoidable, and that's the arena of the family. And I wonder if anybody could comment on how to navigate the dialogue between family members, an extended family, some of whom might be Orthodox and some might be Reform or some might be intermarried, et cetera, et cetera. So.
This is for Rabbi Furstiger. I've heard the idea that there's a relationship between the idea of amachad, like trying to unify ourselves, and what happens to us in terms of our being attacked by our enemies physically. So in a conference like this, could you possibly see a relationship, like this is a tikkun we're trying to do, to figure out how to make us more amachad, and in a sense being more protected from our enemies? Would you think that that's a valid relationship, and maybe this conference might not be so separate from what's happening in Israel?
Hi. Historically, the modern Orthodox Jew in Israel had been the person who could talk to both the Haredim and also to the secularists. That seems to have been lost because the modern Orthodox Jew, or more the religious Zionist Jew, is associated with being part of the movement to live in Yehuda Shomron. Do you see any way for the modern Orthodox Jew to come up again in Israel, the B'nai Akiva type of Jew, and be that conduit so that we get some kind of dialogue and some kind of unity for the Jewish people in Israel.
Okay, that's plenty, actually. Dr. Schick, the first question was for you. The first question is actually similar to a question I was asking about a kind of private-public split. Should the Council of Torah Sages should say publicly about things like bans that this is maybe for the general community but not for every individual?
Unfortunately, the answer is that it wasn't possible. Should have happened, but it wasn't possible because at the stage where they would have gotten into the picture, the ban was already promulgated by Gedolei Torah in Israel, and that was the end of the story. The only time when you can have this private-public split is before a public pronouncement is made. So you can go to a Rav or a Rosh Hashiva or wherever else, you can ask a question and get an answer which will not portray a community which is so mired in cumbers and nothing else. But once you have the ban promulgated by people like Rav Eliashiv or Steinman, whoever it might be, that's the end of the story, certainly for the Meretz Gedolei Torah in America. I just want to add one more point on the second question, very briefly, because I wasn't asked anyone, on dialogue. There's a lot of dialogue in families. Maybe the whole community, again, this is probably a public-private split. We almost all people have in families, people are intermarried, or people who are less religious, people are very religious, etc. And basically we manage to get along. I know there are cases where you don't, but basically we do manage to get along. At the private sector, with people who aren't from, with people who are different than us on the spectrum of religiosity, we know what to do. We don't know sufficiently what to do at the public or communal sector.
I have to say, I just think that's remarkably wrong-headed.
It's your opinion. I said we don't know how to do it.
We all somehow just get along. No, there are major rifts.
No, you got me wrong. I'm saying there are major rifts.
Right.
I said what we've learned to do in the private domain is to act civilly and to have good relations with people who are different on the religious spectrum. In terms of families, definitely.
Take a look at the movie Trembling Before God.
I don't go to movies.
Take it out of the video. Watch it online.
We'll bring it to you privately.
You can get a private Hetzer for a movie if you try.
I would think that on this issue, regardless of whether the private sector were able to handle it or not, anything that would be done on a public perspective between Orthodox, conservative reform, anything like that, would be irrelevant to the individuals. The guidelines that they would be following and would be promulgating would not be relevant to the individual, and every individual's circumstances are so complicated and so different and so individual that anything that goes on a communal level is just totally disassociated from that.
Right.
And on those types of issues, you really need to seek guidance from somebody objective, whether it's a rabbi, a counselor, a social worker, or just somebody who can see it from a different perspective and could talk to the people involved and give you guidance and help. But again, that's a totally personal issue and not a communal issue at all.
I think, you know, very often you hear in these public-private, the rabbi will say, for you, it's okay. I wouldn't need it. For you, it's okay. There is a sense in which what you're describing, and you're describing it in a positive way, very often those kinds of private flexibility, they carry with them a kind of reverberation that says, if you really wanted to be up to the high standards, you wouldn't do it. But, Nebuch, you can't do better. Your situation is a situation. I'm going to give you a heter. Of course, I wouldn't act that way. So I think even in a public-private, you get these kinds of distinctions. In fact, historically it was that way. When they talked about Reb Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, and they talked about his, or Hildesheimer, and they talked about their institutions and their approach in Germany. When they talked about that in Eastern Europe, very often they would say, well, he had to do it there, but here he wouldn't do it that way. There's a sense.
And what's wrong with that? The Talmud has it. This Mishnah would say, this is halacha and anshei maisa, or whatever we'll do.
The nature of history changes, and when you do certain things in a new context, they take on a different meaning. You cannot argue that nothing has changed in the environment in which we live.
Things have changed. That's changed.
Lots of things have changed. And when today a rabbi says to you, for you it's okay, but for someone else it's not okay.
No, we
that suggests a sliding scale of Yiddishkeit.
And there is a sliding scale.
Well, then we need to
there
be
is.
Much more upfront about that.
A sliding scale. There is a sliding scale.
Then we
scale.
Need to be much more upfront and public about it. The sliding scale should not just be a private secret.
Yeah, look, I wanted to get to the question that was asked about, has modern Orthodoxy lost its ability to be a bridge in Israel because of certain events that have taken place? The question was posed saying that there's a kind of right-wing, a kind of secular public, and then there was a kind of religious Zionist middle that was able to negotiate this world. And the suggestion was that, I guess, perhaps because of the settlement issues, maybe because of the assassination of Prime Minister Rabin, that perhaps there's been a kind of loss of that ability to be the bridge. I'm wondering what you think of that, Dr. Furtziger.
I'll get that momentarily. I want to, at least, this is really a projection of my own, not academic analysis, my own personal experience. I think that when parents are educating their children, I have still pretty young children, but I have experiences growing up in my own family and other families, and I think when parents are educating their children, they set a derech, and they send them to certain schools, and they create an environment. They think that once children make their choices, they shouldn't feel that they've lost their home. In my experience in my own family with siblings who made certain choices, and I had a father, Allah Shalom, who never cut them off and always said, our Shabbos table is your Shabbos table and your room is your room. And my experience was, and it's not everyone's experience, but was that ultimately these people came closer, siblings came closer than they were. Some came all the way back. They maintained love, respect, family commitment. And my father, Allah Shalom, died 10 years ago, and I think of what was the legacy I got from my father. It was this type of love that could not be broken. We used to talk, I remember after he passed away, we used to say, is there anything we could have done that could have caused our father to stop loving us? And we couldn't come up with anything. And I really think that that is something that we have to think about, and that the positives that can come from that are much greater than the dangers involved. I hope this conference is a tikkun. I think that's wonderful, and I think if people are positive and people see almost on a mystical level discussing issues of Jewish unity and how to find a dialogue as something which is going to affect the sfirot or affect the klipot, I think that's a beautiful idea, and I resonate to that at some level. In terms of the question that you asked me, I don't think modern Orthodoxy has lost that role. I think that there are issues. I think that the sense of losing homes, I think that the sense of being disenfranchised is something which causes a lot of pain, as Rabbi Bravender described very appropriately last night. And there are fringe factors, factions that have sort of lost their sense of being a part of the nation. But I think that the examples that that at least speak to me are my work in Bar-Ilan and teaching classes with diverse student bodies and using the text of the Torah or using Jewish history or using a discussion, a dialogue over a rabbinic responsum or over a major existential Jewish issue as a means to talk about what Judaism is about, as a means to learn together without trying to convince anyone that one opinion is more is better than the other. I've found in 15 years in Bar-Ilan that there's a tremendous degree of dialogue that goes on. Is it changing society? I remember I once talked to Danny Tropper when I was learning in yeshiva, and Danny Tropper, who founded Gesher, and it was sort of chutzpahdik, it was like a yeshivish chutzpahdik thing to do. I went over to Danny Tropper, who I thought was this great role model, who had, you know, had this, you know, clairvoyancy to realize in the 1960s with David Shon, Alav HaShalom, that Israel, the religious secular thing was, you know, was this great divide, and they should create Gesher to create bridges. I said, how do you feel after 30 years? The religious and the secular hated each other much more than when you started your organization. And you know, I don't think he really gave me an answer, but I think it was sort of an obnoxious thing to do. But Rav Lichtenstein, you know, always said that, you know, lo alecham l'chalik mor v'lo ata ben chorin li batal mimena, and that we do have to continue to work for ideals that we believe in.
Chabadnikim talk about that in terms of messianism. Maybe unity is a sort of messianic type of belief, but if Chabad can gain that type of energy from their type of messianism, I'm not sure that unity isn't a type of messianism that can breed a certain degree of passion. I think that my experiences in the Israeli army as well, and the idea that people are putting their lives on the line for Am Yisrael, I think that that ideal is extremely powerful. And when religious Zionists or modern Orthodox or people who live in both worlds, when those people share the same madim and they are officers or they are infantrymen or they are technocrats or whatever they do, but they share that experience of sacrificing for Klal Yisrael, I think that that is extremely crucial to dialogue. And as I said yesterday, I think that the Israel divide is maybe less, or is moving less towards religious secular and more towards values laden versus more materialistic. And I think that there is a core of values laden people that range from secular to Haredi and everything in between that actually hopefully can draw strength from each other and can create a coalition which will bring Israeli society to a greater sense of collectivity than it's felt right now.
Please give this gentleman a big hand.